Ian Bessarabia, very good morning. How are your kids this morning?
I think they're okay. I'm probably half dressed and half at school.
Right. Well, as long as it's the right half dressed and the right part at school, I guess, then
yes.
Everything's fine.
Indeed, yeah. Well, it's their problem now.
Right, exactly. It's their problem and the school's problem.
Exactly.
As long as you get them there, as long as you get them over that finish line.
It's like handing them over. That's your problem.
Absolutely. Listen, it's not easy to go from a three day, you know, Saturday, a Shabbat, and then Shavuot for 2 days, and then back to school. And then next Monday's a public holiday again. We're relentless with this sort of thing.
Life is tough.
Yes, exactly right. All right, so Ian, we're going to talk about this lot is the future of jobs, and one of the things that we want to talk about today is compassionate leadership. Does it make you a soft leader? Do the good guys always finish last? And it's a very, very real question. I know that my style of leadership is empathic and empathetic. I am compassionate, but I'm also not an easy guy. So it is a much more complex area to inhabit from my own experience than being either just very, very difficult or just very easygoing.
Yeah, Howard, I think what people confuse is that to be compassionate is not a feeling. It's a process, especially in the work environment. And the reason I say that is because as you use the term empathetic, we sometimes get confused between being sympathetic, empathetic, and compassionate. If I can use a quick analogy, to be sympathetic is if you fall over, I walk past you and I say, "Oh, Howard, I'm sorry you fell over." You know, if I'm empathetic, I'll walk past and say, "Oh, Howard, that looks so sore. It happened to me. I'm so sorry." If you're compassionate, you walk past and you say, "Oh, Howard, you fell over. How can I help you? Can I pick you up? Can I help you?" And I think that's where we find in work is that, leaders don't walk the talk. They say they're compassionate, but they're actually sympathetic. And sympathetic means that they acknowledge, but then they move on. And in this age of a different world. You know, we were just talking off air about like rushing around, taking kids to school, having so much to do. Life is tough. Life is stressful. And to have a leader who appreciates that people or employees or fellow colleagues are normal and have a normal life and accepting that and trying to help them out is compassionate rather than just saying, "Oh, I'm sorry you had you spilt all your coffee all over you,"
right,
and all this, but let's get back to work. So that's where I make the distinguish between being compassionate and being empathetic or sympathetic.
So an issue that I often have is certainly in the workplace, and I've seen this over and over again, a couple of things. One is, as you say, leaders not walking the walk. In other words, they'll always say, you know, when I'm, let's say, consulting with them, they'll always tell me that they've got an open door policy and they expect their employees to be able to access them whenever there's an issue. And I talk to the employees and they'll say, "Well, his door is always closed or her door is always closed. So how is that an open door policy?" In other words, they're not accessible. So that's the first conflict that I often observe within workplaces. The next question, and this is the one that I have particular difficulty with, is if somebody's going through, an employee is going through something very difficult at home, often that is going to impact on the work, on their work environment. So you reach out to them, you try and address it, you try and give them a little bit more support in what's going on at home. The problem is that once that figurative door is opened, then it is often perceived as an excuse not to work or an open invitation to continue to deal with those emotional issues in the workplace. And setting those limits is very, very difficult. It is much easier if work stuff stays at work and home stuff stays at home. Of course, none of us are capable of that. That's not real. So we do bring our home stuff and we do bring our anxiety and our stress and our sadness from home into work. But at the same time, so we have to deal with it. But at the same time, if we bring it to the point that everybody is flowing from home to work to home, we create an environment that is absolutely unsustainable.
And that's exactly the problem that we have with remote work. So just to give you a practical example is that Everybody wants to work from home, and then you get one or two individuals that abuse it or they take advantage. And then what the company does is they will typically just take it away from everyone. So it becomes more about a culture in a way. It also becomes more about, the way we actually have mutual respect for one another. And for me, Howard, the most important thing about having mutual respect is being open and upfront, but then understanding that if somebody gives you an opportunity to deal with your kids and that, remember that you can't abuse that, you can't take advantage of that situation. And we had a situation, it was quite interesting. I had a situation the other day where I couldn't make a call and somebody called me out on it and said, "Ian, you didn't let us know." And I said, "Well, how did you contact me?" And I said, they said, "No, I sent you an email." And instead of me apologizing for it, I stood firm on it and I turned around and I said, "Well, please do me a favor. If you need me urgently, contact me on WhatsApp." So it wasn't like I was making an excuse for not being there, but trying to remedy the situation. And for me, it's not about absolving yourself from doing work. It's not about saying, "Well, okay, I've got a situation at home. I can't do anything." It's about being open and honest and saying, "Well, I can't get to my emails today, or I can't come to my meeting, but I've made an alternative plan. You can get hold of me on a video conference and that." And I think that's where leaders need to call out their employees or their colleagues and say, "Listen, I accept that you want to work from home, but I'm going to expect you to also be responsible and accountable for what you do."
In other words, it's taking on that responsibility and saying the problem is that when people are dealing with emotional stuff that they're bringing, let's say, to the workplace that I was referring to before and that you're referring to now, is that they're often, people aren't often in the best position to be able to limit it, because that's such a strong, dominant force within their emotion and brain, and any opportunity to deal with that becomes that. So, how do you suggest an employer, can be compassionate, but also make sure that those lines are drawn and that the employee understands that there's a time and a place for everything? And just because I understand that you might, I don't know, be going through a divorce at home, and that's obviously very, very traumatic, your work still needs to get done.
So I think you're 100% right about drawing the line, and some of the most successful kind of practical aspects that organizations have put in is distinguishing between that your boss, your leader, your superior, your colleague, whoever it is not your psychologist. They're not there for you to come in every morning, close the door and have an hour chat. And a lot of companies, and it's actually brilliant what they do, is they put in these anonymous helplines, or they give people the ability to call into a line 24 hours a day whenever they need to get professional help. And the point is the linking of that back to the organization, because it doesn't help if I phone in every day to the helpline and I'm telling that and the organization is not, that they're not aware that I'm doing that. But at the same time, these organizations, and this is where they're very good, is they distinguish between making sure that they retain persons' confidentiality, but at the same time they have to raise a flag to an organization, to a head of organization or a head of HR. So the point is, you have a safe space where you can pick up the phone and say, "Look, I'm having an issue with my divorce, or I'm having an issue with my kids, and it's affecting my work." The important thing is how those organizations that partner with the companies communicate that back and say, "Listen, you guys just need to be aware of Ian. He's having a bit of a tough time. You just need to be cognizant." And I think that's the second part, is leaders need to be authentic listeners. And when I say authentic listeners, to your point that you mentioned earlier, if you don't want to have an open door policy, don't say you've got an open door policy. If you don't want to listen to what people say, don't encourage them to come and speak to you. You know, if you're not going to act on what they're going to say. So the thing is that people often say, "Well, if I'm a compassionate leader, I'm soft." It's actually a stronger leader that's compassionate, because they actually have to deal with the, the issue.
It's often much harder. Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely.
It's much more difficult to play multiple roles than to play one role.
Absolutely.
You know, to be the difficult boss is probably the easiest thing, especially if that's your personality type. To show both compassion but strong leadership is much more challenging. I'm chatting to Ian Bassarabin. We're talking about compassionate leadership. Does it make you a soft leader? Leslie raises a point. She says, now, not exactly in the business world, but also as an employer of domestic staff, there's also a fine line between being compassionate but also not wanting to be responsible for every issue.
And Leslie's got a very valid point, Howard, is that what we need to ensure is that you don't become weak and you don't now become a soft target for everybody's issues. And for me, it's about setting the, I call them the rules of engagement, but people can call them whatever they want. And it's almost, we talk about putting contracts together. Everybody talks, and just to come to Leslie's specific point about our domestic workers and that, there was a big outcry many years ago about putting contracts in place. And it was done in the wrong way, in my opinion. It was done in a way to focus on equal pay and to make sure that domestics were treated fairly. However, it was missed the point in the sense that it should have been done to create expectations amongst the employer and the employee, because
so that everybody's clear on on what those ground rules are.
Absolutely, and if you set
because often that's a very abused relationship between employer and employee,
and that's the whole point. So you can put guidelines in terms of how much you're going to pay someone or that, but it's a very different role. It's almost like a caregiver in a way. A caregiver role is very different to a 9-to-5. Not that something like a 9-to-5 really exists, but it's very different. When you have a contract, a personal contract, and I'm talking about a personal contract, and that's the thing that's becoming more and more common, is people have businesses typically call them service level agreements, which is effectively how both parties are going to operate. A contract of purpose and a contract of how two people engage with each other set the ground rules from day one. And what that ensures, it ensures that you don't put all your peckles on the table and say, well, these are my problems, you need to accept them. What it does do is it creates an environment of what I always refer back to about mutual respect. And mutual respect says, well, I will help you out if you have a health issue, or I will be compassionate if you need to take your child to a school interview or go to that. But at the same time, I'm also not going to allow you to abuse that, and it's got to be within reason. Now, that's about communicating, and we don't communicate. That's our biggest problem, is it's easier to deflect, and it's easier to move away from that and become indifferent to people's feelings and emotions.
So bottom line, is it possible to be a compassionate leader without being a soft leader?
Yes, it is, and it takes work. So the good news about it is if you've been a tough leader, or if you've been somebody who's kind of deviated away from these issues, you can train yourself. You can become a good listener. You can be truthful. And I think we all have weaknesses. We all have areas that we need to focus on and address. So for leaders, it's about being open to listening. And I go back to saying, if you want to be a compassionate leader, listen. Listen to what the person is saying and understand it from their point of view. And that would be my starting point, is just start by listening.
Absolutely. A very, very good point indeed. Thank you, Ian Bassarabin. We chat to him on a Tuesday when we talk about the future of work. Luke Harpus wanted to know how many people in an indoor cricket team. Ian Smith says 8. David Zimmerman says 8. Unsigned says 8. Indeed, that is the correct answer. It is indeed 8. Wendy says a better attitude for any manager is to be understanding. This encapsulates what is needed to be compassionate without losing respect. That is Wendy.